Sunstone presents Mormons and Eternal Progression. Is there improvement after death? Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
The name of this session is Mormons and Eternal Progression. Is there improvement after death? And the paper will be delivered by Mark Gustafson. He has a degree in philosophy from the University of Utah, and he's currently an attorney practicing in Salt Lake City. And this is the fifth paper that Mark has presented at the Sunstone Symposium. And he is married to myself, and we have three children. And Mr. Bassett, Arthur Bassett, will be delivering the comment after Mark's paper. And Mr. Bassett is well known as an associate professor of humanities at BYU, and he also has given many previous papers at Sunstone Symposium, and you'll probably recognize his name from having published many articles in various church publications. And I remember Mr. Bassett as being an excellent instructor at the Institute of Religion at the U of U when I attended. And so without further ado, we'll turn the time over to Mark to begin his paper.
I must apologize initially because this paper is somewhat longer than I would have liked, and it will undoubtedly be somewhat longer than you will like when I'm through it, so I'm going to proceed with some speed through it. Mormon theology is composed of many ideas unique in the Christian genre. Against a Puritan background which strongly argued for salvation by grace, together with the belief that the human character springs from a state of sinfulness, the prophet Joseph Smith argued for a more positive view of human nature. Smith believed that human beings were born morally neutral and capable of much good when guided by proper principles. Out of this background grew the idea that the end of mortal life need not put a halt to qualitative personal progression in matters of knowledge, moral development, and other virtues. In the King College Discourse, Smith clearly taught that many crucial principles will be learned in the afterlife, that it, quote, will be a great work to earn our salvation and exaltation even beyond the grave. Emerging from the belief that mortal life is a moral testing ground, Smith's notion of eternal progression measured moral character against the various challenges, both mortal and immortal, that life presents. By parity of reasoning, since life is restored through Christ's resurrection, worthy and interested individuals might continue to progress in the afterlife. The notion of eternal progression, briefly described for purposes of this paper as the hope that genuine qualitative improvement might occur after death, is properly considered to be one of the unique elements in Mormon theology that sets it apart from other Christian systems. Whether the idea of eternal progression is commendable or sensible cannot be decided by referencing comfortable parallels with 19th century religious liberalism, nor can it be rejected because it does not fit nicely into present authoritarian religious sentiments. Rather, the idea of eternal progression needs to be carefully examined to see how it developed in the commentary. This examination reveals a conflict between the emphasis on the inherent godliness of the human soul and the too common depravity and sinfulness which characterize so much of everyday life. Only a thoroughgoing review, rather than a mere recitation of basic beliefs, can point out the unique implications that are entailed by the Mormon idea of eternal progression. As if the uniqueness of this idea were guaranteed to produce disagreement, there are strongly competing viewpoints in the Mormon community. Because there is no official church position on the matter of whether eternal progression involves merely inter-kingdom movement in the afterlife or improvement within a prescribed sphere, the written commentary reveals a host of conflicting opinions. President Woodruff's once popular view that any restriction on unlimited progression in the future was repugnant does not represent the settled, if unofficial, view of the church. A host of contemporary opinions hold that neither God nor resurrected mortals qualitatively progress in the afterlife. The tension between the liberal view of human nature and its neo-orthodox Mormon response to the mortal condition is pivotal to this discussion and outlines a point from which fundamental divergence in contemporary Mormon thought is developed. In fact, as the balance of Christendom appears to be heading toward a new universal theory of salvation, contemporary Mormon commentary appears to reinforce Mormon canon's position that only an exceedingly small portion of humanity will enjoy God's presence in the afterlife. This is an especially odd development since traditional and historical Mormon metaphysics is entirely at odds with mainline Christian metaphysics. and inconsistent with the emergent Mormon position. In order to make sense of the confusion, it must be shown that Mormonism can reconcile its historic optimistic view of human nature with its contemporary insistence that there is no progression in the afterlife for both the saved and the damned alike. It must be further shown that Mormon thought occupies a morally defensible ground when it asserts that most souls that have ever lived on earth genuinely deserve eternal damnation. If Mormonism cannot achieve these goals, and I suspect that it cannot, then it may not be able to maintain that it is a coherent, internally consistent, and observationally verifiable theology. This paper will initially review the history of the Mormon idea of eternal progression by examining the statements and opinions offered since the idea was first declared, investigating the implications, strengths, and weaknesses of both the historical and contemporary views. The last section of this paper will offer a reformatory proposal which will hopefully address and embrace the strengths of both sides of the questions of the question, while avoiding the problems inherent in each. In attempting to examine the history of any Mormon idea, one almost expects to encounter a comprehensive and coherent commentary arranged in neat chronological order, which addresses the idea in various contexts and from various viewpoints. However, as in other areas, the commentary is a coarse polemic reflecting the perceptions and interests of the people involved. To compound the problem, the literature is composed of only a modest number of largely informal opinions offered up in church publications, books privately published, or in commentary journals issuing from BYU. As if to further unsettle an already chaotic scene, the church issued two letters, the first on December 17, 1965, and the second scarcely a year later on December 27, 1966, which severally declared that there is no official settled opinion on the matter, despite assertions to the contrary on the part of certain commentators. President Brigham Young appears to have been the first Mormon authority to expressly and continuously comment upon the matter of eternal progression. In the Journal of Discourses, we find Brother Brigham boldly declaring that, quote, We are in this school and keep learning, and we do not expect to cease learning while we live on earth. And when we pass through the veil, we expect still to continue to learn and increase our fund of information. That may appear to be a strange idea to some, but it is for the plain and simple reason that we are not capacitated to receive all knowledge at once, namely immortality. Young moves beyond the ascription of eternal progression to resurrected humanity to also include God by condemning those who would say that God progresses no longer. Quote, it has been stated that God our Father comprehends eternity from eternity to eternity, all there is, all there was, all that might ever be about eternity in and throughout it. When a person undertakes to establish such a doctrine, he gives bounds to that eternity which he at the same time admits to be boundless. President Young also sensed that whether here or hereafter, if one isn't genuinely progressing, one is regressing. Quote, if a man could ever arrive at a point that would put an end to the accumulation of life, the point at which he would increase no more and advance no further, we should naturally say he commenced to decrease. His natural abilities will begin to contract and will continue to decrease until all he knew was lost in the chaos of forgetfulness. There is no such thing that remains stationary. There must be increase or decrease. President Young appears to be the most clear and outspoken advocate of an afterlife where all interested souls, gods and others, might genuinely increase in knowledge and wisdom and other virtues. Young seems to have anticipated the outlines of the late 20th century's theologies of hope. President Woodruff followed Young's early commentary by publicly setting out his views upon the matter just shortly after the Utah community was established. Woodruff seems to have participated fully in the optimistic views of his age, which held that the vistas of human progress and achievement were only limited by enthusiasm, good efforts, and proper spirits of the individual human soul. In the Journal of Discourses, President Woodruff specifically opined, quote, if there was a point where a man in his progression could not proceed any further, the very idea would throw a gloom over every intelligent and reflecting mind. God himself is increasing and progressing in knowledge and in power and dominion, and will do so worlds without end. It is just so with us. We are in a probation here, which is a school of experience. Close quote. In so declaring, President Woodruff argued for an identity in nature and ultimate purpose between the gods and humanity, where both groups would learn and progress until eternity had no further meaning. Apparently anticipating the argument that afterlife progress might be restricted because of a dissolute mortal life, Woodruff insisted that really extraordinary persons might overcome the barriers they have erected in mortality. Elder James E. Talmage followed Swidger's claims in 1899 by declaring that natural reason would require the belief that God would not restrict an interested and deserving soul to a lesser kingdom in the afterlife. He declared, quote, "It is reasonable to believe, in the absence of direct revelation by which alone absolute knowledge of the matter could be acquired, that in accordance with God's plan of eternal progression, advancement from grade to grade within any kingdom, and from kingdom to kingdom, will be provided for. But if the recipients of a lower glory be enabled to advance, surely the intelligences of a higher rank will not be stopped in their progress, and thus we may conclude that degrees and grades will ever characterize the kingdoms of our God." In an interesting pamphlet, Elder Talmage argues that Christ's post-mortal, perhaps eternal task, is to preach repentance and teach corrective principles to souls not residing in the highest degree of glory. Quote, "Through latter-day revelation, we learn that among the inhabitants of the terrestrial world are they who are the spirits of men kept in prison, whom the Son visited and preached the gospel unto them, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh." Talmage may have seen that perfection is an entirely dynamic matter and relative one, that because the universe is characterized by dynamic change, as matter unorganized transmutes into purposeful order, eternal progression is a faithful description of the never-ending actions of all intelligent entities. Talmage might as well have asked whether there are any hard boundary edges to the three kingdoms described in Mormon theology. The record reveals that the question was again addressed in 1948, interestingly just after the Second World War, which many have claimed placed the last nails in the coffin of 19th century religious liberalism. Apparently that World War also marked the first appearance of a view which rejected the traditional Mormon mixture of a positive view of human nature with the idea of eternal progression. Reflecting the sobering experience of the previous 8 years, BYU professor Parley Christensen cautioned his readers that many dangers lay in uncritically accepting the notion of eternal progression without considering the full implications of a belief that ultimate human progress could be achieved. He observed, quote, "It is easy to ask for an eternity in which to progress, but it is difficult to detect when our own progress ceases. It is easy to accept limitless time in which to learn, but difficult not to spend our days in futile reiterations of the little we already know." Christensen was apparently troubled with the too easy acceptance of the idea of eternal progression, which was so often unaccompanied by an anxious devotion to a critical examination of one's mortal life. Christensen and others recognize that religion can become a hollow avocation when stripped of a courageous, inspiring, and anxious quest for truth and beauty, and comprised only of a smug belief that no matter what, every sin and omission might be corrected later. Whatever the source of his uneasiness with Mormon smugness, Christensen recognized that it was still good theology to believe that human progression is echoed in the notion of the progress of God. In rejecting the idea of God's immutability, he argued that God is necessarily perfect only insofar as his works demand that he should be, thus placing a profound burden upon humanity. Quote, "Let God and the world be truly changing, truly improving, and a splendid vista opens before us. We become like young men looking into the track of a sunset. If the movement of the world comes from God, then it must have importance for God. God must be better for it. If God were none the better, then the creation and continued existence of the world would have no meaning from God's point of view." The next clear commentary on the issue appeared in 1960 when President J. Reuben Clark, who grew up under the ideological tutelage of Woodruff, Talmage, and Roberts, enthusiastically reiterated the traditional Mormon support of unfettered progression. Quote, "I do not believe that we seal our eternal progress by what we do here. The unrighteous will have the chance to climb to the destinies to which they who are righteous and serve God have climbed in those eternities that are to come." By so stating, Clark seems to have treated the goal of an open access to progression as carrying more theological importance than a rigid emphasis upon meting out an eternal, immutable justice based strictly on mortal actions. This preference would be explicitly reversed only a few years later. The relative balance between eternal progression and a restrictive view of afterlife improvement started to change just shortly after President Clark's 1960 declaration. As early as 1961, the Improvement Era carried an article which declared that this life was the, namely the only, time for our learning, suggesting that one ought not to rely upon any post-mortal educational opportunities. By this emphasis, we find the emergence of a scenario in which the importance of mortal achievement occurs at the apparent expense of afterlife opportunities, a notion that would come to underpin the ascendant priestly tradition in Mormon thought. The increasingly common rejection of the historical Mormon position on eternal progression was, interestingly, founded on the traditional Mormon idea that there was progression in the pre-life. In the article, Continuing Education and Eternal Progression, published by the Church Educational System in 1964, Richard Henstrom argued that the choices made in the pre-life textured our mortal experiences and, by implication, our status in this life. Proceeding from this premise, Henstrom concluded that, quote, "What we should remember is that this is our time for learning, and that it would be a mistake to relax into a state of inaction in this life based upon the idea that all things will be made easy for us in some future existence." Apparently, though there was significant improvement between our first and second estates, this mechanism is not seen to extend from our second to third estates. The denial of progress in the post-mortal sphere seems to fit nicely into the increasing emphasis on a fairly narrow, rigid path to heaven. You see, if progress is denied in heaven, it follows that actions in mortality become all important. And if this is so, then most people would be naturally somewhat less adventurous and inquisitive about matters theological, instead opting for a carefully orchestrated, prescribed course of behavior set out by an organization whose interests are so often consonant with spiritual dependency. In contrast to the historical view, the modern Mormon position appears to exaggerate the significance of moral choices at the expense of hope, by placing increasing emphasis on the unique and ultimately dispositive nature of mortal life. The new view holds that the blind groping characterizing the 70 years of mortality damns or exalts the souls throughout the untold eons of eternity. It is a startling thought. Picking up on these clues, Rodney Turner and Elder Bruce McConkie have jointly argued that the notion of eternal progression, when interpreted to entail kingdom jumping for certain specially qualified individuals, or even to imply any significant progress in the afterlife, is contrary to the teachings of the Church and obnoxious on other grounds. Elder McConkie echoed his father-in-law's rejection of eternal progression when McConkie declared that, quote, "The celestial and terrestrial and telestial glories I have heard compared to the wheels on a train. The first, the second and third may and will reach the place where the first was, but the first will have moved on and will be just the same distance in advance of them." This illustration is just not true. The wheels do not run on the same track and do not go in the same direction. The terrestrial and telestial are limited in their powers of advancement, worlds without end, close quote. McConkie went on to argue 14 years later that each person resurrected into each of the three Mormon kingdoms would be a species apart from those appearing in the other kingdoms. In his Seven Deadly Heresies speech delivered at BYU in 1980, Elder McConkie dispelled any suspicion that he supported Brigham Young and others of the traditional persuasion. At a BYU devotional, McConkie opined, quote, "There are those who say that God is progressing in knowledge and is learning new truths. This is utterly false, totally and completely. It grows out of a wholly twisted and incorrect view of the King Follett sermon. I have been sorely tempted to say at this point that any who so suppose have the intellect of an ant and the understanding of a clod of miry clay in the primordial swamp. But of course, I would never say a thing like that." Close quote. McConkie therefore links the progression of human beings with the progression of God and denies both on the grounds of his unacknowledged advocacy of traditional Christian metaphysics. McConkie also apparently advocates the notion that celestial bliss is a zero-sum calculation, where the acquisition of a position in the celestial kingdom can only occur at the expense of a similar afterlife achievement by others. Turner echoed these sentiments when he argued that the idea of inter-kingdom progression in the afterlife was, quote, "a disservice to all." To emphasize his rejection of afterlife progression, Turner declared, quote, "There is little reason for concern or urgency if everyone will eventually obtain the same heights. Starting at the bottom and working our way up as eternity unfolds would not be too unpalatable. Life should not be regarded as a tentative interim judgment that can eventually be reversed or modified." Notice here that Turner seems concerned with the perceived inequity of the mortally sinful soul achieving with the mortally righteous, an eventual equivalent amount of reward and blessings. There is no room in Turner's theology for the prodigal son who returns not to his mortal house, but to the eternal home. Turner may equate a failure to mortally progress with an eternal disinterest in progression. While some may choose not to progress here and hereafter, one simply cannot presume eternal disinterest from a slothful mortal life. Turner makes a serious error when he suggests that there is some injustice to the mortally decorous if the mortally indiscreet might someday achieve the same level of afterlife position. Turner ignores the obvious point that both the mortally righteous and the immortally penitent could earn, albeit at different times, an equivalent reward. To Turner, it only seems to matter when you achieved your reward. Since Turner, McConkie, and others drawn a line between the notion of kingdom jumping and progression within a framework set by mortal actions, finding both ideas unsavory, it is not out of place to inquire into the reasons that the traditional idea of eternal progression has fallen on hard times. It is one thing to argue that eternal progression is contrary to the selective declarations of Scripture, and quite another to set out the real reasons underlying such a rejection. You see, qualitative human projection, as defined by Joseph Smith and others, as we have seen, is inconsistent with the neo-Orthodox Mormons' nearly wholesale adoption of traditional Christian metaphysics. Namely, if you believe that God is omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, and immutable, then it will not do, and one might not argue, for the ability of mortals, by their own virtues, to become godlike in virtue and power. It may be true that the contemporary Mormon shrugging off of the historical notion of qualitative eternal progression is driven by a rejection of Mormon metaphysical pluralism. Moreover, there may be a link between an increasingly authoritative religious sentiment and the decline in the notion that every interested person might progress and learn forever. These suggestions might provide us with an insight into the motivations behind contemporary Mormon thought by recognizing that Mormon theology may be going through a rewriting, pushed along by the needs of some to emphasize the exclusivity of God's love. It seems to me that the rejection of the idea of untrammeled afterlife progression may turn on the fundamental opinion of the nature and state of the mortal soul. Turner hints at this foundation when he declares that only a very few will inherit the highest degree of glory, for the apparent reason that almost all persons are carnal, sensual, and devilish, and capable of yielding to the enticements of the Spirit. Of course, there is some reason to agree with Turner, McConkie, and other contemporary neo-Orthodox Mormons when they reject the traditional Mormon link between afterlife progression and a generally positive view of the mortal human soul. The experience of the 20th century has provided scant support for the religious liberalism of the 19th century, when most of the world had not yet been ravaged by war, and where 65 million people had not yet died at the hands of dictators, both fascists and communists. In fact, it seems that the early Mormon pessimism regarding human nature, found in Mosiah and in sections 132, 76, and 88 of the Doctrine and the Covenants, have been amply reflected in the experiences of this century. But there is no reason to believe that a theology of hope has been rendered insensible or unpraiseworthy by the last 70 years of human history. Just at the time when we need to emphasize the capacity of human beings, here or hereafter, to achieve genuine qualitative progress and perhaps even virtue, contemporary Mormon philosophy seems to be running for cover, taking strength from its peculiar adoption of neo-Calvinist sentiments. Contemporary Mormon belief and practice appears to believe that humanity, as a group, is irretrievably sinful and metaphysically unable to achieve virtue here or hereafter. If one adopts the view that most people are burdened by an inherent nature so sinful that only a few will inherit the highest degree of celestial glory, it is not a difficult step to argue for a hierarchical, authoritarian religious structure which ought to be the focus of the lives of the faithful. Under this view, the select few, somehow saved from the burdensome nature that afflicts their fellows, are both those properly in positions of leadership and authority, and therefore those whose judgments are inherently more dependable. Under this analysis, a framework has been established for the belief that people need to be carefully monitored in their religious activities because of their presumed individual inability to achieve celestial glory. There is little room, then, for the enthusiastic views of human values that motivated 19th and early 20th century Mormon literature. Under this analysis, eternal progression is often viewed as a quaint idea, having no contemporary application. The problem of reconciling the observations of human sin with the traditional Mormon emphasis on the Mormon perfectibility of the human soul must still occur. This goal is essential to the metaphysical and ethical viability of the Church. Having briefly examined the historical and contemporary opinions on the matter of eternal progression, one wonders whether there is any way to reconcile the observational facts of human action without destroying the notion that hope will and must, peculiarly within the Mormon context, spring eternal. One must have some unrefined sympathy with the neo-Orthodox rejection of the 19th century's enthusiastic endorsement of mortal improvement and, by extension, genuine human progression. One simply isn't facing facts that the cruelty, sinfulness, and depravity characterizing most of human history has ignored. Therefore, we can forgive McConkie, Turner, and others the unreflected instinct to believe that only a small remnant of humanity will be sufficiently free of moral atrocities to exclusively command a position at God's feet. However, we can neither tolerate nor forgive the entailed and often explicit view that any person's state of blessedness is increased in value to that person by the recognition that a very great number of other persons do not and will not share in that state. Those holding the current Mormon views on this subject must demonstrate what may well be denied them by their theory, namely, that there is some motivational difference between unlimited future hopes and unimaginable but still limited future possibilities. That is, so far as mortal contemplation is concerned, is there any significant difference between contemplating an infinite set of numbers and an indefinitely large set of numbers? A further trouble with the Mormon Neo-Orthodox rejection of eternal progression is that it inherently entails a hierarchical metaphysic where the overwhelming mass of humanity is denied involvement with a God who seems deaf to the pleading of souls who recognize, some later than others, that they wish to repent and to improve. The alternative view of deity as a God dispensing wisdom freely to all and generously embracing all morally praiseworthy actions whenever occurring is done significant damage by the ascendant Mormon view. The contemporary Mormon position denies itself and everyone else the unmistakable joy and affirmation which comes from worshiping a God whose eyes gleam when humanity achieves goodness and kindness and moral decency. On other grounds, one cannot insist that infants do not need baptism, yet simultaneously believe that human beings, when left unguided, will almost always go astray, separating themselves from the will and spirit of God. The supposed alienation from God is and will remain at odds with the idea of redemption and eternal progression that has characterized the broadest portion of the Mormon theological heritage. The opportunities for ideological abuse flowing from the Mormon Neo-Orthodox position are many and pose a serious challenge to a religion which has not yet given up on its belief that human beings are not born sinful and depraved. It appears that contemporary Mormon viewpoints comprise a set of very troublesome beliefs. The notion that this life carries ultimately dispositive effects on our future progression entails the remarkable idea that we are to be judged eternally when we have been purposely cut off from just those ideas and influences that any reasonable person would need to make a series of sensible decisions. And it further argues that an incredible movement from the embryonic pre-life state to godhood can be achieved by traveling a brief time through mortality. Either godhood is a relatively easy achievement, or we are required to argue for genuine, qualitative, and unending eternal progression. As a response, it will not do here to say that God has provided a prophet in order to cure our blindness. Such a functionary carries force only through an act of faith and only addresses the body of the church and not individuals within it. The act of faith necessary to believe the words of a church leader delivers us back to the first premise of our dilemma by suggesting that ordinary humanity requires a special class of persons to dispense necessary religious information and ritual. Inherent authoritarianism. There are also serious difficulties with the uncritical acceptance of the idea that failures in mortal life may be viewed with less than soul-wrenching anguish for the reason that errors of whatever stripe might be corrected in the eternities to come. There is serious threat to an anxious search for an intellectual virtue if the importance of moral life is uncritically and incorrectly undermined by a cavalier attitude concerning the unique challenges that face mortals. Some special importance surely attaches to measuring our reactions to mortal challenges, the evaluation of which must and ought to have some profound influence in our future progress. To think otherwise is to reduce mortal life to a blind parlor game, where no one is held responsible even for the most heinous acts, or where there are no consequences for a profound misuse of precious opportunity. As with the neo-Orthodox position, the uncritical acceptance of eternal progression runs the serious risk of ruining a soul by stripping mortal life of the urgency which lends it meaning and flavor. Wisdom probably lies in the recognition that some balance must be struck between trivializing or exaggerating the choices made in mortality. In seeking a recognition, the unique Mormon rendition of Imago Dei must be preserved by insisting that the idea of unrestricted eternal progression does not render mortal virtue or mistakes unimportant. Simply, the mortal character is comprised of divine and human characteristics, and it is irreverent to think that God would deny achievement to anyone at any stage. By insisting upon eternal progression, we have suffused eternal life with an appealing purpose and ennobled mortal efforts towards that goal, no matter how slow or faltering. On the retributionist view, there is some lamentable natural force to the hope that some awful people might be subjected to eternal suffering. But Mormon commentary goes well beyond such obvious cases by arguing that even morally praiseworthy but non-faithful Mormons will be denied the enjoyment of God's presence. Thus, Mormon thought not only excludes the truly heinous from God's grace and involvement, but even those who, on any sensible analysis, are ethically praiseworthy individuals. Fundamental Mormon beliefs concerning the restricted access to God seems both at odds with the traditional formulations of eternal progression and curiously consistent with McConkie's view that there is no progression once one departs mortality. It is not clear that present Mormon thinking on the subject is morally admirable. The hoary old medieval argument that God loves the sinner but not the sin is both evasive and not properly considered within the structure of Mormon thought. On this analysis, particularly when factoring in the current rejection of eternal progression, Mormonism occupies a morally anomalous position. So it seems that a reconciliation may only occur when we mesh the observed facts of the vast actuality of human sin and cruelty with the recognition that mortal life, occupying so small a portion of our eternal lives, simply cannot, in the interest of equity, play a dispositive role in our futures. It simply runs counter to notions of justice and of fair play to presume that a very short walk down a dark hall can fairly and finally determine our immortal futures. We must acknowledge and maintain the possibility for future progress, itself an element in maintaining the doctrines of redemption and hope, while keeping in mind the very real disservice that we can do to our future opportunities by failing to recognize that mortality must be suffused with anxious purpose and moral achievement. We need to fashion an ethical and metaphysical system which is comprised of many elements, namely 1, future post-mortal opportunities will be enhanced by acting in a mortal and moral and ethical manner in this life. 2, an insufficient moral life will delay full post-mortal opportunities if left uncorrected. And 3, a newly enlightened eternal personality may progress to the degree and of a kind determined only by the desires and capacities of that individual in question. By arguing that eternal life is a dynamic event where genuine eternal progress might occur, we acknowledge the unique importance of mortality while not insisting that mortality alone determines our immortal future. In this way, we can mesh the pessimistic insights of the neo-Orthodox with the hopeful insistence of the traditional Mormon position. We may have then fashioned a belief system where everyone is properly enjoined to act in the best possible manner in mortality without damning an individual for seeing through the glass darkly. Thank you.
We probably ought to have Gene England up here responding, but I guess maybe they only allow you a couple of sessions at some time now. I think what Mark had to say was extremely provoking in a lot of ways. I wish we had full sessions to probe some of the ramifications of what he talked about. Let me just touch on a few in terms of questions more than anything else. My first initial reaction when I received the assignment to respond and saw the title for the paper having to do with eternal progression was to say, first of all, who knows? And secondly, who cares? But I think that Mark has done a much fuller job than this. My initial reaction in wondering about who knows has to do with a statement that I think was best expressed again by Brigham Young, wherein he said, no man can understand the things of eternity. And Brother Pratt and all these men should leave the matter of the gods alone. I don't understand these things. Not if there's any man in the flesh. We should let them alone. And then, as Marx pointed out, he went on to violate his own instructions here, as Brother Brigham often did. The thing that troubles me when we start talking about eternal progression is that there is a propensity on the part of Mormons, it seems to me, to act as if death is nothing more than a movement to a new location, and that life continues as it does here in this sphere. I think in terms of our theology, and keep wondering if we take it seriously, if we talk of a God that is omniscient, if we talk about a God who hears my prayers and your prayers and literally thousands of prayers simultaneously, a God whom I've always been taught understands my thoughts each moment of the day and thinks then literally billions of people's thoughts simultaneously and keeps track of his own thoughts at the same time, creates for me some problems that absolutely boggle my mind. And consequently, I set aside these problems a long time ago, realizing, or at least assuming, that I didn't have the ability to do anything with them that was terribly meaningful. But as I listened to Mark and as I read his paper, I see that there's much more in it, and I'd like to go through and just do a basic synopsis of what I think I hear Mark talking about. I see in his thesis the idea that the prevailing response today is to say that there is no progress in the church. I mean, in the life beyond this. Prevailing response in the church is to say that there is no progress beyond this. I don't know. I wish that Mark could have pushed that a little further, other than just Rodney Turner and Bruce R. McConkie's ideas, assuming that there is a general movement in that direction. I kept wanting to see more substantiation of this fact. I have a gut-level feeling that what we are seeing in the church today, in terms of this argument, are general authorities who are no longer interested in doing theology in the traditional sense of the word. Brother McConkie was something of an anomaly in that situation, at least as I think of it. Of them, I think of none that are specifically engaged in what I would call speculative theology. And we may want to push this a little further. I'm glad that Mark's wife got to him before he presented the paper as he had given it to me and took out some of the rather, what I consider to be, irreverent comments about the BYU religion department. In assuming that all this is coming from there, I think it's a grossly overstated observation. Secondly, I hear Mark going on then to say that he senses a kind of rising authoritarianism in Mormonism, signaling what he calls the rise of the neo-Orthodox stance. He talks of ascendant priestly traditions. He talks of increasingly authoritative religious sentiments. He talks in terms of suffocating assistance of an authoritative religious structure. And then he moves to the point that there is today a more of an emphasis on the church as a means of salvation. And then a corollary of that, that the leadership of the church becomes crucial to our salvation by being what he calls this special class of persons who receive the guidance from the Lord and keep the others in tow. Have I read you partially correctly there? Okay. Now, just a couple of observations. One has to do with methodology. One is involved with terminology. I am extremely concerned about what I hear coming out of Sunstone over and over and over again in the use of the word neo-orthodoxy. When Mormons start to do Protestant theology, I think we sometimes work without the kind of basis that we ought to have. I think that Reinhold Niebuhr and Richard Niebuhr, who are the major advocates of neo-orthodoxy would be extremely concerned about being placed in a setting where we're talking about authoritarianism. Anyone who's read either of the Niebuhr's books see their emphasis on democracy. They're playing down of those kind of things. And I realize the term is being bannered around a lot here at Sunstone. Scott Kinney is about the only one I've heard talk at Sunstone who seems to be acquainted with the basic historical status of neo-orthodoxy. I think what we're talking about is a neo-Calvinist stance, and I noticed Mark used that term on one occasion. The neo-orthodox talk about perfection as an impossible possibility, and the whole concept of eternal progression is, it seems to me, inherent in much of what they say. Plus, I think we need to be careful as Mormons in terms of talking about things in a kind of Mormon exclusiveness. The idea of eternal progression, I remember, and I'm not sure which of the three that it is, but it was either in Charles Chauncey's writing or Jonathan Mayhew's or William Ellery Channing's writings in the first of the 19th century that this was talked about. I remember one of them talking about the fact that the scriptures refer to the immediate afterlife situation, and that we are short-sighted to suggest that God can't then go on from that point to bring everyone to a kind of perfection. I was reading some of Margaret Fuller's literature yesterday. She says it blatantly, I believe in eternal progression. So what I'm suggesting here is that I think here at Sunstone we need to be a little more careful sometimes in the way we talk of Protestant theology, because I think we need to hone a little better our terminology. The term progression was a little oblique to me as well through this. I think one of the things we need to talk about in terms of eternal progression, the kind of thing that is crucial to what Rodney Turner's talking about, I think, has to do with how progression is achieved. Is it achieved in terms of what you know? Is it achieved in terms of what you do? Or is it achieved in terms of what you become? I think Mark was brilliantly on the mark when he compared it to that parable of the prodigal son in the future. I think, as some of you know, that I think Mormons have a hard time with that parable, but I think it's one of the crucial parables of the Saviors. I'll pass over the innuendos about the BYU Religion Department, BYU Publications, the appreciative audience at BYU to which Brother McConkie spoke, and pass on to some of the other problems now I see involved in what Mark's talking about. I'd like to sit down and just talk with him for a long time about some of these, because I think he's onto some crucial issues. And as always, when we place ourselves before an audience like this, you really do put yourself in a position to take all kinds of flack, and I hope you won't see that in this, see my comments in that regard, because what I'd like to do is to push out the problem that he's talking about a little bit more. One of the problems I think we need to look at a little more carefully is this relationship between theology and the church stance. If I understood Mark properly, what he is suggesting is that the reason that we're not talking about eternal progression so much today is because the church is more concerned about controlling the people through the stance of suggesting that most people are short of where they should be morally and ethically within the church and this kind of thing. I think when I look back on this, and one of the things I was surprised that Mark didn't mention in his historical account of this is that argument that went on between B.H. Roberts and Orson Pratt. If you're not aware of it, Orson Pratt, at least as I understand it, was practically drummed out of the church for teaching the same thing that Brother McConkie did. Some of you will be familiar with the other publication that's printed by the church other than Sunstone. And in 1980, Brother Bajero did a rather complete account of that conflict. Several times Orson Pratt was called before the leadership of the church, before the Council of the Twelve, and severely chastised for being in direct opposition to Brigham Young and saying that there is no progress beyond this life. In fact, it got to the point that eventually Orson Pratt was called upon by the 12 to stand up in conference and deny that same stance that I think I hear Brother McConkie teaching. the point I want to get back to is this idea between the theology and the church stance. If what Mark says is accurate here, then it seems to me that we have a hard time explaining why in Brigham Young's administration, when the idea of an advancing God was very prevalent amongst the leadership of the church, at least, the Council of the Twelve and Brigham Young and Orson Pratt being the token negative voice in that stance, why then was the church as authoritative as it was then? We have the case of the Godbeites, for example, who were, again, called on the carpet for being in opposition to the church leaders. I think that when you look at Brother McConkie's stance, it has to be seen to a large degree in terms of a personal matter. Brother McConkie's father-in-law, as Mark has indicated, President Joseph Fielding Smith, took this stance a long time ago, and I think that Brother McConkie is kind of a family position as well as anything else in defending President Smith's stance as an advocate of that position. And then when it became prominent, again down at BYU, to talk in terms of God progressing, then I think Brother McConkie took it as kind of a personal attack on his theology, and this, I think, led to the great heresies talk down there. I think it can be seen in a personal sense as well as in a philosophical stance. Now, let me get to this larger problem that I see Mark introducing, which to me is one of the most difficult things we wrestle with in the church. And it has to do with what I think some of us sense as a kind of growing authoritarianism at the top levels. Mark is suggesting that it seemed to have emerged after the Second World War. I think I would look at it in a slightly different way. I think that I see it emerging as a result of two things. One is the growing church. And with the growth of the church throughout the world, we're meeting now for the first time some of the problems that Roman Catholicism met a long time ago. The problems of unity and diversity. And how we bring together people in this unity that the Lord talks about. You know, if you're not one, you're not mine. The very word atonement having to do with an at-one-ment. The whole concept of Paul's teaching over and over again. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. Unity is essential to the growth of an organization, but the plurality also has to be accounted for some way, and that I think is the major problem the church faces. I think I can be a little sympathetic with the brethren at this point. We had an occasion as a BYU study abroad to spend some time in London and talk with people who were converts to the church over there, and they talked to us about how upset they were that a lot of the BYU students came over there and were drinking Coca-Cola, which to us seemed like a very small thing. But when you get into a situation, I'd been a missionary over in England 20 years before that time, and I knew that certain things get pressed and they become kind of badges of identity, and then when they see anything shaken in the least degree, being young in the church, they have a hard time with it. I wrote an article some years ago on Joseph and his marriage in Egypt. They've republished that just recently in church publications. I'm getting letters again from the ensign saying people are deeply disturbed by the fact that I said Joseph married an Egyptian woman. And very small things like that have a tendency to be very shattering to new members of the church. And I think the brethren are justly concerned about that kind of thing. I think we have to see almost two kinds of church, the people who have been in the church and people who are new. I think the second point I would look at in terms of that problem of growing authoritarianism has to do with the instigation of the correlation program in the church, where you bring in a group of laymen who have to wrestle with all the problems of bureaucracy, and that is pleasing those who are above you, trying to see yourself as the spokesman for those above you, and the caution with which they move. The caution that has frankly appalled me at times as a writer, and I think we have to see those two forces coming together here, the brethren's concern for new members of the church and the whole idea of trying to get together a correlated program where we have achieved some kind of unity within the church. And then there are programs like we're experiencing today with Sunstone, with Dialogue, with the Mormon Historical Society and such, where members of the church are raising issues that are probably legitimate issues. The media come and pick out the more spectacular issues and record them in the paper. And that's what the Brethren see. And I think they see a kind of challenge to traditional theology and the working through those kind of things. So there are all kinds of factors, it seems to me, that are coming together and need to be talked about today in the church in understanding this problem of unity and diversity, because to me it's one of the most perplexing problems that exists in the realm of organized theology. Now let me conclude just with one other comment. I think there's a better problem to discuss than is there progression beyond this life, and that is the problem of why there is apparently retrogression in this life. You know, we talk about the fact of coming here, everybody fought for God, everybody stood up and cheered and shouted for the opportunity to come down here, and then we come down and act like we've been acting, see. What is it that happens? Is it a physiological problem in the way people are hooked up in their mortal bodies? Is it an economic problem? Why do we see this degeneration? I suspect that when we pass to the next life and get rid of some of the economic and bodily problems and other things that we have, we're going to see a very interesting situation. The prophet Joseph's 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, when he talks about getting together the murderers and the liars and the thieves and the whoremongers and all the other sinners and putting them together into a kingdom of glory that surpasses all understanding, to me, has got to be one of the most blatantly optimistic stances ever taken in relationship to man. And I believe that there are a lot of questions like this that we need to address, and I applaud Mark for coming at some of these. It's an extremely difficult and widespread problem that I think we need to, like I say, have several sessions on several different points. But I think Mark needs to be commended for attacking it as he has today.